You're listening to Critical Reads. This show is designed to help people critically analyze topics like race, culture, and faith, one resource at a time. I am your host, Neff Lesperance. Hi there, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Critical Reads, the podcast. I am your host, Neff, as it says in the intro. I thank you so much again for joining me today on this episode. And for those of you who are new to the show, welcome. I'm super excited to have you all here and listening to me on this brand new year. I know I took a little bit of a break. I figured with the holidays, and then I was working over the holiday break since, and now I am working in healthcare. I decided to be kind to myself and just take some time off and not produce and spend time with family when I could and do what I needed to do with work. And then I figured once things slowed down with work, I could jump back onto this. So here I am, I'm back. I hope that everybody had some time to rest and had some time to just spend time with family and de-stress. I know it was also kind of difficult for a lot of you all because of COVID and just the craziness of everything that's been going on with that. I know a lot of my friends have been catching it left and right, but I hope most of you were able to heal up okay if you did end up catching it, or that your family members or your friends were able to heal up okay, and that we just continue to, you know, be as safe as we can be in the middle of this. It is kind of crazy that we are basically about to hit year two, and the CDC and the rest of the powers of be still don't have any idea what the hell they're doing. But regardless, I mean, the most that we can do is just take care of each other and take care of ourselves and just do the best we can not to catch this thing. Or if we do, just recover from this the best we can. And I did also want to add, I know it's been weird to already start this new year with just a bunch of, you know, famous people passing away, from Bob Saget to Betty White. Betty White especially was one that really hit me because I love Golden Girls, and if you know me, you know that about me. And so just knowing that the last Golden Girl passed away was kind of a tough one. But I will say it was really cool to see that she was a person that actually wasn't problematic. And it seemed that people were just very saddened by her, you know, loss and all that. So that was encouraging to see how her life was, you know, very impactful for a lot of people. So, but again, it was sad. And with all the people that their family passed away, famous or not, I just continue to have them on my mind and my heart, because I know it's hard to just lose somebody that you care about and trying to navigate what are the next steps as a family and all that. But yeah, so my heart is definitely with all of these families. And then so today, as we are, you know, diving into this episode, as always, I'm going to let you guys know what book we're doing. We're going to be covering a book called Changes That Heal, 4 Practical Steps to a Happier, Healthier You. This book was written by Dr. Henry Cloud. I will be taking some time to introduce the book and the author like I always do. But before I do that, I wanted to take a minute just to open up with the segment I call Musings of a Tired Black Social Worker. And this is when I usually just take some time to just reflect on something interesting that kind of caught my attention or that just has been on my mind in the past week or so. And so for me, there was a lot of different topics that I was like, ooh, this would be good, this would be good. But I think the thing that's been sticking with me consistently is just with COVID-19 and just looking at how people are navigating, dealing with it, especially given that, again, we're like 2 years in almost on this. And I will say that there are a lot of thoughts, but I know briefly it was just one of those things this past week that it really was challenging, especially being myself working in a healthcare setting, just being frustrated by the fact that there's not a lot of great leadership around this area, even though we've been 2 years in. There's still a lot of decisions that seem to be being made for the purposes of more so making money, getting people back into the workforce, or getting kids back into school, I guess, and all these different things. But it's not, it just has felt like there's not really a good sense of direction on how to deal with this stuff, especially with regards to just giving people the right equipment and materials and the things that they need to stay safe, right? Because again, I know myself, I'm happy with just chilling in my room and never going anywhere. But I do understand that there's a lot of people out here that's like, they want to have concerts again. They want to go to outings again and whatever. But the fact that we can't have a collective like, okay, here's testing sites, here's protective gear, here's, you know, reasons why we should get vaccinated that don't have bullshit like conspiracies to them. Like, it's just, you know, it's just been really frustrating again to see that we're just not making any progress. And it's, and I know for me as an idealist too, when I'm seeing what is really out here and how, you know, what the ideal could be, I know for me it's been really difficult to just like navigate those feelings and manage those feelings. And I think the final breaking point was for me this past week where one of my units at work, that's usually COVID negative kind of space because they test our patients first and whatever, it officially became like a COVID positive area. And so I was kind of like forced to work on that area without really any good training or whatever. And the frustrating thing that people don't recognize is a lot of times in healthcare or even in the schools or all these different areas, the people that are in charge, they don't always do a good job of like communicating, hey, these are the steps, these are what we're going to do, this is how to protect yourself. Sometimes they don't even do a great job of providing protective material for you guys, like masks and all that stuff. Like I know even with my family, because we're very diligent and we don't want to catch this thing, we oftentimes are buying our own stuff, which is crazy. And I know a lot of other nurses and stuff have to think like on their feet too of how to protect themselves when they're going to work, right? And so, I don't know, that's just been very frustrating lately, is like a lot of people who are having these arguments about research and, oh, we just need to get things back going, and they're not thinking about how it's affecting everybody as a collective. I wish that they could spend like an hour in the spaces that we have to be in. I wish that they could spend an hour or two in our hospitals and seeing how everybody's just strained, how there's shortages and staff, how there's like no communication really going on, no real sense of like, how do you protect yourself? And yeah, it's been really, really, really like difficult lately to just not feel like giving up because of how frustrating that stuff has been. And so I am praying for those of us who are still in this bullshit after, you know, 2 years. I know for me, I will be honest and say that I've only really been in this almost like 6 months or so, working and deep in like the medical field and all that. But I'm exhausted after 6 months. And so I imagine for those out there who have been, you know, 1-2 years into the healthcare field and are feeling exhausted and tired of seeing people like pass away from this, tired of hearing how people are not even trying to work with us collectively to make this group, horrible group project, just go away. It's been a nightmare. And I'm doing my best to stay optimistic and not be frustrated and be able to go back to work and stuff. But again, it's just been on my mind lately, and it's been just a bit of a clusterfuck, to be honest. And so, yeah, I just am praying for everybody out here in these streets, and I pray that you guys continue to just stay safe. And if you can get vaccinated and you still haven't done it, please consider doing it. And even if you are vaccinated and you can wear masks, please continue to do that stuff until we have a better sense of control over this. Because, again, it's just been hard for a lot of us in the healthcare field to just navigate all of these different pieces and figure out how to take care of other people and take care of ourselves and our families and all that stuff all at once. So the compassion and the empathy is really something that I really hope we can try to push this year, because, you know, we're tired. I know I've been tired. So with that said, that was my rant for today. I would like to just jump into this book by Henry Cloud that I'm going to do today, called Changes That Heal, Four Practical Steps to a Happier and Healthier You. I'm really excited to dive into this book. I think whether you're religious or not, because I know he does talk about religion a lot and Christianity in this book, it really just gives everybody, whether you're Black, white, Hispanic, older, younger, whatever it is, it just gives people such great insights in like how to be an adult and how to deal with boundaries and a bunch of different things. And so I'm excited to dive into this book and kind of share a little bit about how it just challenged me as I read this. And I read this a while back when I was an undergrad. So reading this again has been very timely, so to speak, and which I'll explain in a little bit. But I really do hope that, again, regardless of the religious undertones or the religious parts of this book, that you guys can just be willing to engage with it after I explain why. Because, again, it just brings up a lot of great things that I think every adult should be willing to wrestle with. And so before I dive into what really stood out to me, I'll start by first doing what I do and just introduce the book and the author. And so from how the author and the publisher describe it, they kind of say, many of us struggle with anxiety, loneliness, and feelings of inadequacy. We know that God created us in his image, but how can we be loving when we feel burned out? How can we be free when we struggle with addiction? Will we ever enjoy the complete healing God promises? Combining his professional expertise and personal experience, renowned psychologist Dr. Henry Cloud guides us through four basic ways to become a joy-filled, mature follower of Christ. And then these four ways are basically connect more deeply with others, separate from others in healthy ways, understand the good and the bad in ourselves and in others, grow into greater emotional and spiritual maturity. With fascinating case studies and helpful techniques we can start using immediately, Changes That Heals reminds us that God promises to complete his good work in us. And again, I know there's some religious undertones, and I know when I first read this book again, part of me cringed a little bit because of where I'm struggling right now with faith in God. But again, as I read this book, I really do feel like this is one of these occasions where I didn't see somebody trying to use scripture to make it fit his way of, I guess, gaslighting people or making you feel guilt. I saw him using scripture in a way that was freeing, if that's fair to say. And so I think if you get past the initial feeling that you may feel, for those of you who are struggling with faith right now, again, this man brought up a lot of great nuggets. And again, I'll explain it more in a bit. But first, we'll talk a little bit about who Dr. Henry Cloud is. And so, again, reading off of the blurbs that he has of himself online, I know, again, a lot of these things may have changed, but it says, Dr. Henry Cloud is an acclaimed leadership expert, clinical psychologist, and New York Times best-selling author. His 45 books, including The Iconic Boundaries, have sold nearly 20 million copies worldwide. He has an extensive executive coaching background and experience as a leadership consultant, devoting the majority of his time working with CEOs, leadership teams, and executives to improve performance, leadership skills, and culture. Dr. Cloud is a graduate of Southern Methodist University with a BS in psychology. He completed his PhD in clinical psychology at Biola University and his clinical internship at Los Angeles County Department of Mental Health. Dr. Cloud founded and built a healthcare company starting in 1987, which operated inpatient and outpatient treatment centers in 40 markets in the Western U.S. There, he served as clinical director and principal for 10 years. In the context of hands-on clinical experience, he developed and researched many of the treatment principles and methods that he communicates to audiences now. After selling the company, he devoted his time to consulting and coaching, spreading principles of hope and life change through speaking, writing, and media. Dr. Cloud's work has been featured and reviewed by the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Boston Globe, Publishers Weekly, Los Angeles Times, and many other publications. Success Magazine named Dr. Cloud in the top 25 most influential leaders in personal growth and development alongside Oprah, Brené Brown, Seth Godin, and others. He is a frequent contributor to CNN, Fox News Channel, and other national media outlets. And again, like I've said, usually I read these little backgrounds of the authors that I'm reading about because I do want you to see that these people have some background in what they're talking about. And then I think just understanding a little bit of their background can help us understand a little bit of where they're coming from when they're writing these books. Obviously, they're not always going to tell you everything about who they were when they were growing up or whatever. But I always encourage you guys to do some extra research and take the time to even understand where this person's coming from their perspective, as much as they've shared, you know, because obviously don't stalk these people. But if they share a little bit about themselves throughout their social media, whatever, I think it's just good to kind of understand some of the person's background before diving into their content. So why did I pick this book? I would say when I first read this book, it was recommended to me by, I think, a staff member with Campus Crusade or Crew when I was a student leader of the FIU chapter, or Florida International University, for those of you who are not from Florida. This book was very popular amongst our staff team. I think also because this was probably around the time where the term boundaries was such a big word that was used, especially around like predominantly white spaces. So it would come up a lot. And after some time, some people on the staff team, I think, started reading this book. And then as a leader, they recommended for some of us to read it. I will say I did read a good chunk of the book when I was a student leader, and I loved it. It really spoke to me. There's some things I didn't remember when I was reading it again. I was like, oh, wow. But now that I've read it again, I feel like it was a great reminder for me, you know, of the things that I still need to work on, but also in being able to see like how much I've grown since I've read this book the first time. And so today I will talk a little bit about that too. And I will say that, you know, me talking about this book will be a little different, and that I will share a little bit of both of like, what are some ways that I wasn't doing so well with this book and how it read me to filth back then. And then what are some ways I've changed and how this book has also read me to filth now as I've read it again. So I'm looking forward to, you know, having this kind of a dialogue with you guys, even though I know you guys won't really necessarily be able to talk back to me about it. But all that to say, this book was recommended to me, and it's a book that I'm happy to read through every once in a while to just remind me of like some of the good tips and things that he talks about. And I also just appreciated how really practical and relatable a lot of this content has been. And again, whether or not you are following, you know, the Christian faith or not, I do think there's a lot of nuggets in here, regardless of your spiritual background, that this book really speaks to. And I think it's a great book, again, for anybody that's diving into adulthood, right? And so when we talk about the general topic or the issue that Dr. Cloud is bringing up, I wanted to read what he says the purpose of the book is, because I thought it was really cool. He says in the beginning of the book, in pages like 16 and 17, "My purpose in this book is not to get enmeshed into the church's debate between psychology and theology. I have a different goal in mind. I want to show you that there are biblical solutions for your struggles with depression, anxiety, panic, addictions, and guilt, and that the solution lies in your understanding certain basic developmental tasks, tasks that you may have failed to complete when you were growing up, and tasks that bring changes that heal. These tasks involve growing up and into the image of the one who created you. And so again, yes, there's religious undertones here. And for me, I do personally believe that there has to have been something that created us. So this did speak to me. And I do believe that this God who created us made us in a way that is very similar to him, and that we were kind of created to, you know, imitate him as a person. And so I did like that he brings that part up, and even in his little purpose statement. And then he then goes on to explain through Genesis 1:27, like he uses that to kind of explain people are basically created in the image of God. And he states, like, because we are created in God's image, we have the abilities to kind of emulate or model a lot of his attributes and characteristics. And so in saying this, he goes on to add, like, obviously, we're not going to be able to reflect some of God's attributes because, you know, we can't necessarily be all powerful or all knowing and some of the other things that he is. But some of the things that we can be is more loving, holy, faithful, loyal. Like, there's some other good qualities of God that we as human beings are able to be if we're willing to do that. And so he's, after, you know, talking about some of these attributes, that, you know, if we work to become more like God and try to be, you know, the attributes of God that we can be, the less we will struggle with emotional problems. So in this statement is such an interesting argument. I think at first I was kind of hesitant of like where he was going with this. I don't remember how I felt about it. When I first read this book, I was probably eating it up because I feel like, you know, back in the day, my little evangelical self was just eating up anything people threw at me. But which is not necessarily a bad thing. But I feel like at first I was like, whew, this is like a huge leap or a huge statement to make, Henry. Where are you going with this? And so I like that from there he kind of says, since becoming like God doesn't seem practical, we try to solve our day-to-day problems by splitting them into two different categories. We ask, is it an emotional problem or a spiritual problem? If we are struggling with an emotional problem, the Christian psychologist is called in. If it's a spiritual problem, the pastor gets called in. We assume that our depression, panic, guilt, or addictions have little or nothing to do with our spirituality. These are two separate issues. All of our problems stem from our failure to reflect the image of God because Adam and Eve fall into sin in the Garden of Eden. We have not developed the image of God in the vital areas of our person, and we are not functioning as we were created to function. Thus, we are in pain. And so when I, you know, read this part of the book, a lot stood out to me, especially being a person that happens to be a Christian and also loves social work and therapy and mental health and all that stuff. I know a lot of the times I struggle with feeling like I have to choose one or the other. Like, now I'm a little bit better of it, but I would say that especially more in the past, I felt like I had to choose between mental health, psychology, and all this stuff, or God. Because I feel like until now, there weren't a lot of people within the church that wanted to have honest conversations about how both things are important, that mental health and God, or mental health and faith, or psychology and theology, that they didn't have to be separate things, that they could be something that could be combined together. And so I say this, like, now seeing how, you know, from the 90s until, you know, now as an adult, there's a lot of people wearing like God and therapy shirts, and people looking at therapy and psychology as something that you can use alongside faith, as a tool that you can use to grow as a human being and to become a better, healthier you and create healthier churches and church spaces. And I will say that obviously there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in that area, because obviously there's a lot of people leaving the church right now because there are parts of the church that are still trying to separate the two and not deal with what needs to be dealt with. But again, it's been nice to see that as, you know, more of us are being more vocal and trying to go to therapy and do our work, there's a lot more people that are willing to challenge the church to be healthier and also be healthier themselves and create communities of health. I mean, as much as possible, because, hey, we're still people that fuck up. And so that really just stood out to me as I was reading this, the idea of, like, we don't have to separate the two. We need to unite the two. Both theology and mental health or psychology or whatever you want to put it are important, you know. And then he later shares the four aspects of the personality of God that he says that if we're willing to imitate, we will greatly see improvement in our day-to-day functioning. And so these aspects are basically how to bond with others, how to separate from others, how to sort issues of good and bad, and how to take charge as an adult. And so throughout the book, he basically divides it into about five different parts. In the first part, he talks about the three ingredients of growth, and that's where he takes some time to talk about grace and truth and time and how you need all three of those things to really help you grow. And I'll talk about a little bit of what stood out for me for that section in a minute. And then from this there, he goes to the second section where he talks about bonding, what it means to bond to others, what happens when we fail to bond, how to learn how to do that better. Then he goes into separating from others. And I think this is very important because he really dives deep into this concept of boundaries and why it's important to develop them and what happens if we don't learn how to develop good boundaries. And again, I'll talk a little bit more about what stood out to me in a minute, but I know especially for me as a Haitian, as a woman, there's a lot of things that I was like, shit, I was not very good at this. And I'm still learning, but it was nice to see how much I've changed since the first time I read this book. But boundaries is just such a thing that in my community, especially with Haitians, we just don't have fucking boundaries in our families. It's very big on, like, you sacrifice everything for your family, even if it comes to the detriment of you. So I like that he uses the part of the book to explain why it's such an important thing to do have these boundaries and to not be afraid to set them, even if it means that, you know, your family, your friends, or whoever are going to be mad at you, right? And then in the fourth part, he talks a little bit about sorting out good and bad. And I did like this chapter a lot because, as I talked about earlier in this episode, is I'm an idealist. So it's so for, you know, this the idea of figuring out the real self with the ideal self, or like real people, like the real other with the ideal other, or like the real world with the ideal world. It's always been something that I struggled with because I will always see or believe the best of others or of the world or even of myself sometimes. And when those things fall apart, it's a clusterfuck. Like, I get very upset. I have a hard time not seeing red and focusing on what is actually happening sometimes. And so again, it's something that I've worked on a lot, but it's still something that I struggle with. And I noticed it a lot, even at work recently, of how I'm like, this is not how this should be. But because, you know, how work is, I'm in a tizzy and I've been having a hard time. So it's very important to, again, sort out the good and the bad in a healthy way. And I like that he spent some time talking about that and talking about what happens when we don't do it. And then the last section, section five, he talks a lot about adulthood and what it looks like to be an adult. And I think this chapter is so important because I think a lot of the times as adults, or you know, we have this desire to lead and to separate ourselves from our family, to own shit, to do all this stuff, which is not bad. But there's a lot of stuff with adulthood that we forget to do to be healthy. And a lot of it is really like sitting down and sifting through the issues that we have with like bonding and like setting boundaries and working through our shit so that we can be healthy adults. And there's so many people that really struggle with that. And right now I'm 31 and I know there's still a lot of areas that I have to grow in, but the way that he defines adulthood and he talks about being an adulthood is something that I always agree with. And it makes me sad when I see other adults that are not at least willing to be honest with themselves and do the work of being an adult, you know? And so I like, again, that he talks about this in this book, what it means to be an adult, why it's important, and what happens, again, when we fail to grow up, especially when we're afraid to separate ourselves from, like, our families. And I know, again, me being Haitian, it took a while for me to grasp what that really meant for me, especially in terms of, like, you know, not feeling guilty and separating, like, these are the needs of my family and my community as being Haitian community, which is, some of it was great, some of it was not, but understanding that it was okay for me to separate myself and find what I need for myself too. And if that did mean that I took on some of the things that my family wanted me to take on, because it was actually good for me, that's great. But if it meant me rejecting some of the things and my family members being upset, that was okay, you know? And again, I like that he helped us, like, kind of learn how to do that. And each of the sections, he really gives some practical tools of, like, how to set boundaries, how to become a mature adult, how to bond and all these different things. So for me, I really enjoyed the layout of the book in that sense. And so really quickly, I wanted to go through some ideas and things that I liked. And with this book, I will do it a little differently because, again, I don't want to give away the really important parts of the book. So for this book, I wanted to do something a little differently in that I wanted to just briefly touch on, like, some of the important points or some things that kind of stood out to me in the chapter. And then I wanted to just focus on some of the symptoms that he talks about. So when we fail to do some of these different things, like set boundaries or deal with good and bad conflict and stuff like that. And particularly too, I like that he in each chapter talks about some of the distortive thinking that comes with failing to do the things that we need to do, the four things that he talks about, which again include, you know, learning to bond with others, separating from others, sorting out good and bad, you know, becoming an adult, etc. So he does take some time and talks about some of the distorted thinking that comes with not doing those things, if you fail to do those things. And so I thought for this book, it would be perfect to really talk about some of my shortcomings and some of the ways that I struggled with some of these things. And again, some of these were, I guess, past tense. And there are things that, you know, I don't want to say overcome because they still come up every once in a while, but I've gotten better at dealing with and recognizing when they're happening. And then there are some of them that I was like, oh shit, I still deal with this. So it was nice to really go through this book and in a way be read to filth, but also, you know, receive some challenges, and which I liked. And then again, I did like that he used scripture in a way that wasn't like toxic. It was a way that he used scripture in a way that really just challenges you to think about what he's saying and come away with it and be like, oh man, yeah, this is actually something that can be healthier for me to do. So with that said, let's get into some of the chapters that spoke to me. So the first part that really spoke to me and that I thought was really good for the laying the groundwork of the book is he talks about the three ingredients of growth. And obviously, like I mentioned, the three were grace, truth, and time. And so obviously, I love that he takes the time to define grace and saying that it's basically unmerited favor of God towards people. And then ultimately, like, you know, because we receive this unmerited grace and unconditional love and acceptance, we are supposed to be doing that for other people, right? So that's one thing that we're supposed to do. The other thing is showing truth. And truth is basically sharing what's real, telling things how they are, which again is another important part of, you know, the human existence. And I just like that he mentioned, like, just as grace is like a relational aspect of God's character, truth is like kind of a structural aspect, right? So I think this is so important because a lot of the times when we look at the church, we see that there's either too much focus on the relational or too much focus on the structural or the law, but it's not enough of marrying the two. And so Henry takes a lot of time to explain that at the end of the day, grace in itself can be great, truth in itself can be great, but if you're not taking the time to have both those things happen, the person will not be able to grow, because truth without grace can sometimes be seen as like just judgment, and then grace without truth basically becomes license to do whatever the hell you want to do, which is not good. And then obviously with the last point, time, he's basically takes the time to highlight that with time, when you use grace and truth together, you are able to experience space and opportunity to kind of work on your imperfections. And again, this needs to happen in the context of community, or ideally, this should be happening in the context of community. And so from there, he dives into talking about bonding and why that's important. And the way he defines bonding is the ability to establish an emotional attachment to another person. He also says it's the ability to relate to another on the deepest level. And when two people have a bond with each other, they share their deepest thoughts, dreams, feelings with each other with no fear that they will be rejected by the other person. And then from there, Henry kind of goes on and makes like a biblical case for bonding and why it's important, which I really appreciated. I like that he talks about God and the fact that God, if we think about him in the context of him being a Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, he exists in a relationship. And so because he models and he exists in relationship and he models love in that relationship, that's why we can look at that and emulate it and want to model that and strive for that kind of relationship within people that we know. And I know, you know, our world where we are right now really values independence and individualistic whatevers. But I like that this chapter was a reminder of why relationship is such a foundational part of who God is as a person, and why, since we are created in his image, is such an important part for us to do that. And I think as much as we want to say that being an individual and, you know, striving for our independence and all that stuff, as much as those things in some ways can be important, I would argue that the idea is that we shouldn't be doing that at the cost of not being able to bond with each other. And I mean, that's what he's going to eventually talk about, like how that's different from being an adult. Like being an individualistic asshole compared to just being an adult are two different things. You know, that's how I read this. But anyway, so when he talks about bonding and he explains all of this stuff, at the end of the day, he's saying without relationship, without attachment to God, without attachment to each other, it's hard for us to really learn how to be our true selves and really be human with each other and just be human in general. And again, I know there's a lot of pushback when it comes to the religious part of this, I guess, but I would say even within myself, when I was an undergrad and I was taking time to know myself through the eyes of God in some ways, I actually did experience a lot of freedom, because as I was leaning into God, I was leaning into community. Little by little, I started learning more and more about who I am as a person, what I really believed. And the cool thing is I had friends within my community that allowed me to be myself. And then I was able to eventually break through and foster a bit more independence and feel a little bit less sad and depressed and a bunch of different things. So all that to say is community and building together can be a very beautiful thing if it's done right. And so that's something that I really appreciated in his explaining and the stories that he used, that you got to see some ways that bonding was done poorly and some of the ways that bonding was done in a way that was like life-giving, which I've experienced before. And then again, what I liked about how he ended this chapter is he talks about symptoms that come from failure to bond, right? And there were a lot, but the ones that really stood out to me were depression, feelings of meaningless, emptiness, sadness, fear of intimacy, and excessive caretaking. And those were the ones that stood out to me because I know when I was really bad when it came to bonding with other people, these symptoms are really the ones that were very apparent in my life, especially the one that was excessive caretaking, because I would constantly take on this role of like caretaker, you know, someone that was always putting the needs of other people first, because there was something in me that was just very desperate for like love and relationship and intimacy. And instead of me recognizing that I wanted those things and I needed those things, I was just trying to, you know, find it by just doing things for others and serving others. And after a while, when that stuff wasn't really working, I felt like one of the distorted thinking patterns that he brought up, people will always leave me. That was something that was constantly in the back of my mind. Like, people are going to leave me. People are going to leave me. And it wasn't because like I wasn't serving them enough, right? But it was more so because I didn't really know how to communicate what I needed from them. And after a time, our relationship was merely just in a way transactional, I feel like, too. So there's only so much that can happen there, especially it's either on my end, I'm exhausted and I want to stop doing it, or on the person's end, the other person's end, like I stop doing the things that I guess were no longer useful anymore. So the relationship fizzles out, right? So at the end of the day, because I was struggling with figuring out how to really bond with these people, with people, and really open myself up to people, I saw a lot of these symptoms kind of come out. And I mean, I'm still working on, like, you know, obviously like the fear of intimacy thing and some other things, but it really helped me kind of put into perspective like, oh wow, like this is what I was doing. Wow. And so I'm learning now how to not just, you know, excessively, you know, do the caretaking role, but actually learn how to just really learn how to communicate, this is actually something that I need and I need to receive from you as well. And it's not just me just doing all the time. I don't know if that makes sense, but I guess so. That was one of the things that kind of stood out to me a little bit in this chapter. So the next part that stood out to me was the importance of separating from others. And that's where Henry talks a lot about the importance of setting limits and having boundaries. And again, there's a lot that he talks about with boundaries here, so I'm not going to dive in too deeply in it. I did love that he took some time to explain stories of where people set good boundaries, where they didn't set such great boundaries, and how all of that went. So I think in this chapter, he did a really good job of doing that. But what I will say that really stood out to me is I love that, again, he used the example of God and the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. And he, again, laid like a biblical basis for why it's such an important thing for us to have boundaries. And I love that he first talks about how at the end of the day, again, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit are always connected. So they have this idea of oneness. They have this idea of unity. But within this unity, you also see that there's diversity. So you see that the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit are still very distinct. They're very separate. They're not like fused together. They don't lose their individual identities. They have like boundaries between them. They have their own like talents, responsibilities, wills, personalities. And so in saying that they do that, he's saying that also like they're able to do this without losing their relationship with each other. And then in addition to that, you see that this God, this deity, this being, they're separate from each other, but they're also separate from creation. And that, you know, we're kind of able to do our own thing, and God is not like just fusing with us, but he still can have a relationship with us, but then allow us to be our own separate things and have our own identities and wills and responsibilities, etc. I like that he adds, he knows where he ends and where we begin, which is such an interesting way to look at this, right? And so with all of this, he's saying that in the same way on a human level, we have to recognize that even as we're created in his image, we all are very separate from each other. We're all meant to have our own personalities and our wills and our talents and our responsibilities. And we also have to understand that we can have our diversity and still be united. You know, we don't have to like morph into each other. And I think this is such a very important thing to talk about, because I think oftentimes with Americanism or evangelical Christianity, even we find ourselves in a place where we no longer really value the diversity within the church and the uniqueness that we have. A lot of the time, acceptance means that we have to, you know, become uniform. We have to be the same. So I like that this chapter really pushes back on that a little bit and challenges us to kind of look at identity and individual, like, you know, talents and will and personality as a good thing. Especially for me, I am encouraged by, you know, thinking like this too, because like I know from my experiences and working a lot of like ministry spaces or corporate places or wherever, oftentimes we get so caught up in uniformity that we become part of a system that navigates on groupthink, where like everybody has to be the same, and the person that's in the group that thinks a little differently or is a little different, we like try to push them out. And I mean, we see that even a lot within a church system as well. But I like, again, that this book is inviting us to be okay with that. Even if it makes you uncomfortable, let people in the space that are different from you talk with you, engage with you, bond with you. And in those differences, like, not only does it help you grow as a person, but it helps the other person grow as a person too, which is, again, what we're trying to do, growth, you know. And again, with that, with the space, the grace, the time, whatever, like, you're both challenging each other to sharpen each other, right? And again, this is ideally done in a space that's could be safe, in a space that's open, honest, loving, like all of those things need to be there. And so some of the symptoms of failure to setting boundaries, my favorite, depression, then there's anxiety, passive aggressive behavior, which that one called me out because I used to be very passive aggressive. I don't do it as much anymore, but I was really bad at it. And then codependency, resentment, feelings of obligation, over responsibility and guilt. And again, I picked out the ones that stood out to me the most because those were the ones that I struggle with either currently or I've struggled with really bad in the past. But the one that really, really jumped out of me was the over responsibility and guilt. And with this, he says that people who do not have clear boundaries feel responsible for things that they should not be responsible for, like others' feelings, disappointments, and actions. They feel guilty for not being what others want them to be and doing what others want them to do. They feel like they're bad for not carrying through on their responsibility to make others happy. And this one called me out the most because I know this is something that I struggled with a lot, especially given my family background. I feel like in Haitian culture, with my parents especially, there's a sense of like, you have to obey me no matter what. Even if it's something that is detrimental to me, like, because, you know, especially as I'm getting older as an adult, there were ways that I was seeing like God guiding me, or just the way that my desires and my talents were guiding me were like left compared to where my parents were going. And a lot of the times me trying to figure out how do I set my boundaries and tell them like, hey, I want to do this, even though you want me to do X, I would constantly feel bad and guilty and feel like because I wasn't living up to the expectations of my parents, for example, to become a doctor, I was failing. I wasn't a good child. I was being selfish, all these different things. And because, you know, I was going through all these things in my mind, I ended up feeling a lot of resentment. Passive aggressive behavior was up the wazoo for me with them. And then anytime I would interact with my family, obviously, I did it out of a sense of obligation instead of out of a sense of love and a desire to really bond with them. And so obviously, because I was having those feelings with my family, where it's, you know, a lot of us start our understanding of bonding with others with them, that slowly started morphing into my outside relationships too with friends. And it turned into me being a people pleaser, very codependent. I didn't have my own sense of identity or thoughts. Everything that I wanted to do, I chose to do it because either my parents wanted me to do it or a friend wanted me to do it. And it took me a while to finally be like, no, Neff, like, you can love these different people, these different groups of people, and still, you know, do what you want to do. Because if you don't learn how to do that, you're always going to be unhappy because you're saying yes to things that you really want to say no to. And then you're going to those events or you're doing those things and you're miserable the whole time. So what's the point? You know, so I had to challenge myself in a lot of that thinking. And again, this is stuff that I've done a lot better in. But I know even now, as I was reading this book, I had to re-challenge myself, because since I've moved back home as an adult, I've had to relearn how to do a lot of this stuff, because it was very easy for me to slowly slip back into the patterns of, okay, like, I'll do this because I don't want to make my mom or dad mad at me. I don't want them to be disappointed in me. But it was stuff that I'm like, I know I don't want to do this. I know that it's fair for me to have a boundary, especially because I work this many hours and I know I don't even have the capacity to do this for them, this task that they're asking me to do, you know? So again, it's something that, again, I've had to work on all over again, because even though I made great strides, especially since I had moved away and went all the way to Chicago, now that I'm back here and there's more access to me, I have to figure out how to do the boundaries thing while I'm at home. So, and then again, the distorted thinking that stood out to me of the list that he brought up was this idea of, like, I'm being selfish for owning my own life, right? And I think especially as a person that struggles with caregiving a lot, a person that is in even the helping field, it's very easy sometimes to be like, oh my gosh, like, if I'm not working on making other people happy, then I'm being selfish. When in reality, it's like, no, Neff, like, you need to sit the fuck down and rest, or you need to say no to this because you're already putting time into X, Y, and Z, and you won't have time for that, right? So I like, again, this chapter really challenged me about the importance of setting limits and boundaries. And then the last one that I want to talk about came from the importance of dealing with the good and bad conflict. I'm not going to talk about the adulthood one because, again, I want you to read the book. And basically, he was just saying how it's important for us to learn what is adulthood and why it's important for us to grow up and separate ourselves from the original caregivers that we had, because he defines our relationship with our parents especially as one down relationship, basically where the parents or older adults are kind of like higher up than us, and we have to learn how to bring ourselves kind of into an equal standing. So I'll let you guys look into that a little bit more and just talk about sorting the good and bad. But I would say that I did enjoy that conversation about the one down relationship and understanding how to be equal. So with this section about figuring out how to sort this idea of like good and bad conflict, there's a lot of great gems that he talks about in here, from like understanding the biblical perspective of good and bad, understanding the ideal self, the real self, and how those relate to each other, how we react to that, how we distort things. Like, there's a lot of great gems, but I think what it really comes down to is what he says when in the beginning of this chapter. He says, in the world around us, we require perfection, and we devalue any church, group, or job that fails our expectations. Either we withdraw from the church, group, or job only to move to another imperfect and disappointing situation, or we idealize situations in a way that blind us to their bad points. In short, if we do not have the ability to tolerate and deal with the simultaneous existence of good and bad, we cannot successfully deal with and live in this world. For the world and we are precisely that, good and bad. So this alone in this chapter was a read because for me, I know I really struggle with the ideas around idealism, which ends up being a symptom of the failure to deal with a good and bad conflict. And so this was a challenge for me even in the past and even now, because I know if things are not going very well and not like, and then it comes to the point where all I see is the bad that you are doing and the imperfect that you're doing, it's so hard for me to not want to withdraw from that. I'm even noticing that in myself right now at work, because all I'm seeing is the shitty stuff that they're doing. It's hard for me not to want to just withdraw and like not even try anymore and just be like, fuck y'all, I'm done. I'm just going to be here. And people, of course, notice, like, they're like, oh, you're not being yourself. And I get that. But again, it comes to the point where I recognize that my idealistic side is like, I don't know how to deal with this good and bad thing and like work within the space that I'm in where this is the reality and how can I work with it, you know? And so again, I liked with this chapter that he says that because again, it called me out, but it's a reminder of like all of us do this. I think even right now in this space that we are with deconstructing, it is important obviously not to be in spaces that are really toxic to you. I'm not saying that you should stay in something that's toxic, but I think it is very quick of us to be like, okay, this isn't serving me anymore. This isn't helpful. And we don't always know how to like sit in that moment and have that conflict and work stuff out and try to figure out how to, you know, work together and bond with each other and heal through whatever it is. Instead, oftentimes, I think we definitely see it in the evangelical church is like, oh, something in their church isn't going well. The person leaves and they start their own branch or they start another church and all that. You know what I mean? And it's not to say that sometimes, you know, we shouldn't do that. But I sometimes wonder how many situations could there have been where instead of starting something out, something else somewhere else, we could have taken real time to really change what was going on. And then we saw growth happen in the church in a way that's really draws people in, that really creates a healing space. And we didn't have to do all that, right? And of course, this requires that everybody in the church is learning how to do a lot of the things that are described in this book. But again, my idealistic side is like, ooh, like how great would that be, you know, to just understand that, you know, people are going to hurt us, but how could we learn to do this together more, you know? But anyway, all of that to say is that I do like that he talks about the ways that we struggle to deal with this conflict of good and bad in our lives. And he says that there's usually four different ways. And he says three of them are usually not that great. And the fourth one is better, right? And so the three that he says aren't that great were denial of bad, denial of good, attack and judge, and acceptance. And obviously, denial of bad and denial of good are both bad because in one situation, you're not even trying to recognize like some of the sinful things people are doing, or you're not even trying to call them out on the stuff that they're doing that are not great. But then in denial of good, you're only seeing what the bad that the person have done, and they're not trying to acknowledge like, no, there's some good thing that this person has done, and those are good, you know, too, right? And then when you talk about attack and judge, I feel like that's pretty self-explanatory, because when you're judging each other, as we talked about in the past, you know, with just looking at only truth, only judgment never actually allows people to grow or feel like they're open to grow. They just feel condemned and like you're hurting them, and that you don't really give a shit about who they are as a person. Like, it's never good. I think one of the things in the beginning of the book, he really does talk about like how detrimental, you know, just truth alone is, and how it leads to anxiety, guilt, shame, and all that stuff. And so I do think that's why, again, he's reiterating this importance of not just attacking and judging people, because once people start shutting down and they feel stupid, worthless, hurt, you know, all these different things, it usually closes the conversation and doesn't allow any room for growth within the church or wherever you are, right? So that's why, again, that's another bad thing that can happen if you're not dealing with the good and bad conflict very well. And then obviously the last one is, you know, acceptance, which again, what all of us should be striving for, is understanding like both, again, good and bad happen at the same time. And we have to learn again how to deal with that. And it's not to say that we're okay with it. And it's not to say that we just let things be, right? Like it's still okay to call things out in kindness and humility, gentleness, and all these different things. But it's also accepting like this is where we are, you know, and let's figure out how we can use grace and truth together. And again, with time, to kind of make the adjustments that we need to, but also like love each other, right? And so like with the other section, there's a lot of symptoms of failure to deal with this that stood out to me. He called them coping problems, which is another great way to put it. And so for me off the top, there was a lot of things, but the ones that stood out to me was like perfectionism, idealism, inability to tolerate negative feelings, all bad me. And that one is basically where, you know, sometimes people just believe that they're all bad and they're not able to see their strengths as well as their weaknesses. And I know with that one, I've adjusted a lot and I've gotten better. And now I can actually see like, okay, these are the areas where I'm trash, but these are some of the areas that I'm pretty good at. You know, it took me time to get there, but I remember in the past, like everything I did wasn't good enough. I would constantly set goals for myself that were just unattainable. I was trying to be perfectionist and to the point where sometimes it would even make me sick and give me anxiety because I wasn't able to deal with it. So that was one that I was like, oh shit, yeah, that was. But then like currently, I think the perfectionism one is an area where I've noticed that I struggle with, especially when we talk about when we fail to see the good and bad. And the way he describes perfectionism is basically perfectionism is an extreme or excessive striving for perfection of self, others, and the world. Everything must be without flaw or it is not good. We can see this in work, relationship, hobbies, and feelings. Perfectionism is the demand for a pre-fall existence and the rejection of any person or thing that is not perfect. And I will say, it's not that I'm that extreme with this, but I feel like with me, I have this thing in me where I'm like, ah, like, yeah, this is not how we should be doing this thing. And so I know like later on with the distorted thinking part of the book where he talks about some of the distortions that we have in our thinking, he says one of them was, I can't stand an imperfect world. And he goes on to say that this distorted view keeps many people slaves to perfectionism. They think they cannot be happy in a less than ideal world. They become so disappointed that they reject whatever is less than ideal and they miss out on the real. And I think when I first read perfectionism as a coping problem, I was like, yeah, maybe it's not that bad. But when I got to the distorted thinking part and how we distort our thinking, that called me out because I know right now I've been struggling so much with the fact that our world is just really less than ideal. It's the reality has been trash in a lot of different ways. And because for me, I don't see any hope of us changing the real to anything near the ideal, there's a lot of me that just shuts down, doesn't want to try anymore, just wants to give up. And I know there's a point where I even had a conversation about it with a friend of mine. And she, of course, there was this challenge that she gave me of like, Neff, like, yes, things are not going to be perfect, but you can still find ways to enjoy and find joy and all that stuff. But I know in my head, I just have a hard time with letting go of like, damn it, like, this is not what this is supposed to be. We could do better. And so because I'm constantly, you know, whether it's me being idealistic or perfectionist or whatever it is, or just seeing all bad, like, I just have such a hard time lately with connecting and challenging it as and not going into this state of like sadness and depression and whatever because of how things are. And so I thought like this part of the chapter was a good challenge for me to kind of revisit, okay, things may not be great. And of course, it's okay for me to want things to be different. But how can I still live in the reality and find good things and enjoy what it is instead of just, you know, just being like, oh, this is all shit, and like just trying to disconnect altogether. And so I still don't know what that looks like for me, but I know when I think about this book and things that I want to take away from this book, this is it. This is one of the biggest takeaways for me, is like figuring out how can I find a way to sit through the good and the bad in a way that's healthy for me, that I could still continue to live, I could still continue to grow, to love, connect, bond with people, and just like live my life with the reality that, you know, things kind of suck, but there's also good. So this chapter was a huge call out for me that I want to continue to go back to and try to challenge myself. So hopefully in a year or two, as I read this again, I could be like, oh, cool, this is something I worked on. And it doesn't have to be something that I'm like, oh, shit, I'm still, I don't know. So I guess here's hoping. But overall, I did like really enjoy this book. I especially love that, you know, Mr. Cloud here just took a lot of time to fuse this thing with like real life stories, case studies. I love psychology, so I love that there was like a shit ton of psychology in here. I'm also a huge theology nerd, even though I'm going through my season right now where I'm struggling with faith a little bit. But I love that he took the time to just talk about scripture, and he connected this to this topic in a way that was like healthy. And it wasn't really designed to shame you, even though there were things that you're like, ooh, this calls me out a little bit, you know, but it wasn't like shame. And he even calls out like the importance of, you know, not making the conversations about growth and healing and all the stuff that he brings up in this book, not doing it from a space of shame and guilt, which I loved, again, that he talks about that. Because I think a lot of times in the church, we're guided by shame and guilt instead of anything that's actually good for the healing of humankind. So I love that. So lastly, as I end this show, I want to talk about briefly, how did this book like challenge or provoke me or force me to kind of see the world differently? And for this, I wanted to talk about some points that he brought up. And he basically, in his book, there's a part where he says, the truth is that we need to be responsible to others, not for them. We have a real responsibility to those in need. However, we must require responsibility from the able-bodied, not to do that is to enable them to remain immature. Then he later says, we help God bring people to maturity when we say no to their irresponsibility, when we say no to their abusive or enabling behavior. We are serving as God's hand of discipline in someone's life. We are helping them realize their own boundaries. So I thought these two little sentences or paragraphs or whatever were really important and really thought-provoking, because I think oftentimes, like, there's a lot of people in the church that are immature. They're doing very horrible, abusive type things. And there's people that are like very aware of it. But instead of them calling them out in truth and love and challenging them to be different, they're just kind of taking steps to enable it. They're taking steps, or they're saying things to kind of like dismiss it, undermine the person that's challenging them, all these different shit. And for me, I like that he took some time and he challenges us on that stuff too, and saying that part of having boundaries and setting limits means that we have to know how to kind of challenge behaviors that are not appropriate, challenge behaviors that are immature, that don't really lead to adulthood or to us being adults, you know? And so for me, when I read some of these sections in the book, it reminded me of this idea of sanctification in the church. The idea of sanctification is basically the process of making someone like free from sin or purifying them. And I think this concept of sanctification for me has always been interesting, because there's so many people within the church that have been Christian for 10, 20, 50 years. And you look at their lives sometimes and you're like, what changed? You are still the same like shitty, horrible person that you were pre-Jesus, you know? And you're still more concerned about your individual self. You don't care about the collective. I mean, right now we're seeing that a lot of the church doesn't even want to wear a mask during COVID, or they're throwing events that can lead to people being sick. Like, so there's stuff within our church, and I know I'm just shitting on the church right now, but I think this is a collective problem. But within the church especially, for me, it's just been something where I'm like, if you have gone to church almost your whole life and people can't really see a difference in you, that's a problem. And so for me, when I was reading this book, I think that's an area where I'm like, man, like, even if it's going to hurt me, I want to take the time to really be someone that's open to sanctification, to changing, to growing, to adjusting my behavior, even if it's painful, even if it's uncomfortable. Because I've seen in my life people that people just know through the grapevine that they're not that great of a person. And they'll talk about it. Like, I think about even when I was a student leader with Crew, there were some leaders in our movement that collectively people were like, oh man, you know, that's just how they are. Oh, you know, they're just going through a lot and that's just how they are. And sometimes, like, we do need to give people space to have some of their flaws. But the one thing that struck me about that is that the whole group recognized that these individuals were just very immature. They had very poor boundaries. They were really bad at like accepting responsibility. They were bad at being adults. And instead of people sitting with them and calling them out in grace and love, and yes, we did need to give them time, I get that, but there wasn't really growing, calling them out, telling them the truth. That part wasn't happening. And so because of that, we went through years of, oh, that's just how they are. That's just how they are. And they're just how they are was not creating space for them to actually become a better person, to actually become someone that is sanctified, you know, someone that's loving, more like God, you know, holy, whatever you want to call it. And so for me, I think when I think about those leaders and I think about this book and I think about me as a person, like, I never want to be a person that they're just like, oh man, I know Neff is shitty and immature, but that's just how she is. Like, if somebody's saying that about me, I'm like, oh God, like, I don't even know how I would be able to live with myself if I knew that collectively a bunch of people were just like, oh yeah, that's Neff is usually that bad and immature or selfish or X, you name it. I would rather have a better reputation. And again, it's not just about the reputation part either, but I do think we're noticing and we're seeing in our society, like, we just don't have an ability to like love and bond with each other in the ways that we should. And because of that, we are seeing such an influx of people struggling with depression, anxiety, desires to hurt themselves, you know, addiction. I know with me, I'm working with that all the time, where so many people, because of their difficulties with bonding and going through some of these things that this guy is talking about in the book, they're in my facility, and a lot of them are either wanting to hurt themselves or using things. And every time I talk to them, it's because they've somewhere along their life, they've had such a hard time with bonding and doing the things that this guy Henry's talking in his book, that it's like, oh shit, like this is real, you know? And so I say all that to say, I like that he's saying that we have a responsibility to each other. And in that responsibility to each other, it means let's stop enabling behaviors that don't heal us. Let's stop making excuses for immaturity and allowing people to stay that way. You know, how about we work together to challenge and create healing spaces? And I love that. And I know that this is such a task that is like monumental, and it takes a lot of time and patience and energy, love and kind, and like all these different things. But I do genuinely believe, like, if we take the time to just apply these things that Dr. Cloud kind of brings up in his book, we can really start seeing changes that heal, like he says. And that's something that I'm encouraged by when I read this book. And to end, I just wanted to read one more sentence or two that he puts in his book that I think is a perfect way to kind of wrap up this episode about changes that heals. And he says, when our frailties are understood and loved by others, we learn to accept them into our picture of ourselves and to value the real self, which is not perfect, grandiose, or ideal. We learn to have what Paul calls sober judgment in thinking about ourselves. We learn not to see ourselves so grandiosely, and we learn to value the real self in its frailties, as well as forgive and accept the real self of others in their limitation. And the reason that I love this last thing that I read for you all is that from what he says about seeing ourselves and our frailties and learning to love that, and then loving other people and accepting other people and their limitations, is something that I've noticed since I first read this book, is something that I've noticed about myself that I've been able to do. And that, yes, I still have my moments where I'm like, oh, Jesus, I want this to be better or perfect or whatever. I still have those moments, but I've learned to accept, even with myself, that I can't be perfect. You know, I have this ideal about myself as well that I wish that I can reach, and I'm not reaching it, and that's okay. And so because of that, I'm able to extend the same grace and love and kindness that I extend to myself to other people. And I think with a lot of this work, when we're talking about growing and deconstructing and all this stuff, that's such an important part of this journey of learning how to accept the real, like accept a person for who they are and work with that. And again, it's not saying that we're never going to call them out in truth and love and all that stuff, but it's doing it in a way, again, that heals them, in a way that invites them into the conversation, and the way that shows that you genuinely care and love them and you value your relationship with them. With that, I thank you all so much for listening to another episode of Critical Reads, the podcast. I hope to see you again next week with another exciting resource. And I hope that as you are listening to this episode, that you really are able to take some good things out of it and eventually go read the book, because, again, it taught me a lot and I grew a lot from reading this the first time, and even right now as I've read this again. And so I really recommend it. And again, I can't stress enough, if you're a person that is struggling a little bit with the spiritual stuff, I pray that you just, you know, take it easy and take the things out of this book that, you know, are helpful for you. Like, I guess the whole, like, take the meat, leave the bones thing. But again, I would stress that he does use spirituality and scripture in a way that I think was more healing rather than hurtful. So I would, you know, keep that in mind and take that under consideration as well. But if you disagree, you know, of course, let's talk about it. So yeah. So with that said, I'll see you all next time, and please enjoy my outro. Hey there, and thank you for joining me on this week's episode of Critical Reads. To find out more about me or to consume more of my content, please feel free to visit my website, soulsessionswithneff.com, where I share a variety of things, including blog posts, resource lists, and have a regularly updated calendar for this podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook using the handle @soulsessionswithneff. While you're at it, if you really enjoy listening to Critical Reads, I encourage you to please subscribe to this show on iTunes, Google, or Spotify, and take some time to rate us on these different platforms. Your reviews will really help the show gain some visibility and also give me some much-needed feedback on how the show is doing. I thank you in advance for your time and your support, and until next time, this has been Neff with some Critical Reads.